Now, as you were making your way through these extraordinary career mileposts, tell me how you, first of all, when you made the decision that you were going to have a career in music, was the figure of Marian Anderson in your mind? Had you heard her more than, beside having heard of her? Or when can you first remembering becoming aware of her as a presence?
You know, probably, you know, I think all of us, I mean, I was born in 1938, and I think I couldn't give you a specific year as to when I was aware of Marian Anderson, because I'm sure I heard my mother speak of Marian Anderson. My mother had a great voice, and I had an older sister. In fact, her voices were better than mine. And so I can't tell you exactly when I heard her about her for the first time, but I would say when I went to Juilliard in 63, then obviously at that time I was very much aware of who Marian Anderson was.
When you made this decision to take up music, what had you considered to be the difficulty for you as a black classical singer? Or had people talked to you about this?
Well, they hadn't talked so much about it. I remember when I was a student at the University of Iowa, William Warfield came and did a recital. And I've never forgotten that. That was probably 57, 58. But while I was at the University of Iowa, this teacher, Charles Kellis, heard me singing in the Old Gold Singers, which was a choral group at the University of Iowa. He's the man that told me, he said, you have a voice to sing opera. And I more or less said, what's opera, having come from Centerville, Iowa? And he said, you do have, he loaned me recordings of great singers, including Leontine Price and the great Italian-based Cesare Siepi. Because I had had no exposure to classical music or opera music, needless to say. And I heard these recordings and some other singers, and I said, I really like that stuff. I remember I called it stuff. And he said, well, you should go to Juilliard School of Music. So he arranged audition for me at Juilliard. And I flew out there in 63 and auditioned, and they offered me a full scholarship. They got a Rockefeller grant for me right away. And then I was kind of somewhat aware. I'd heard about Marian Anderson. I'd never heard her sing live, needless to say. But I knew about her, but had it not been for this teacher, I would not be sitting talking to you today, because he's the one who introduced me to classical music, which in turn led me to start reading up, or not reading up, but recognizing people like Marian Anderson, William Warfield, Todd Duncan. But Marian Anderson was, let's say, the one person who really kind of brought recognition because of the difficulty she had singing as a black woman. And so that's when I was aware that there were, let's quote, once I got out to New York, there were problems for people of color in opera and in classic music in general.
When you began your career, it seems to be bifurcated that you had extraordinary success in Europe, beginning, as you say, with this stint at the Deutsche Oper, and then you sang everywhere. You sang at Covent Garden, You sang at Scala, and for me, most importantly, you sang at Bayreuth. And if I remember correctly, were you the first black male singer to sing in Bayreuth?
The first black male, and there hasn't been one since either. I made my debut in Bayreuth in 1978. In the title role of the Flying Dutchman. It was a new production opening the season. And even then, some of the German papers, at least one wrote that they would boo me off the stage because they didn't think a black man should be able to sing in Bayreuth, and especially a title role in opening the whole Bayreuth festival season. And so, yes, I was. Grace Bunbury was the first African-American person to sing in Bayreuth before I sang. And I did Flying Dutchman while I was there. Then a new production of Parsifal, I sang that also at Bayreuth, the role of Amphortas with James Abai conducting.
It's really an extraordinary thing because I think when I was looking at trying to see different roles that you had sung in Wagner, that you'd been in Tannhauser, you'd done Parsifal, you'd done Dutchman, and you'd been in Tristan.
I did King Mark. I've sung all of Wagner's operas except for Die Meistersinger. I've done Lohengrin, Tannhäuser, Flying Dutchman, the whole Ring cycle. I even sang Hagen in Götterdämmerung years ago out in Seattle. I did they always did the operas in English and German. and they hired me to do Hagen, which is the in Götterdämmerung,
right.
Which, of course, is the fourth opera in the Ring cycle. And nobody else, to my knowledge, in history has ever done that, because when you do Wotan in the Rheingold and in Wotan in Die Walküre and in Der Wanderer in Siegfried, they never cross over and do Hagen. And I actually did Hagen before I did the Wotans when I did it out in Seattle years ago.
You're right. I mean, it is an extraordinary thing. It's funny you would say that, because when I was looking at this list, I thought to myself, oh, what a shame you never got to sing Hagen, but you did.
I did. In English and in German in Seattle with Henry Holt conducting. Paul Robeson, that's the man I was thinking of.
I was going
to
say, were you thinking of Paul Robeson, right?
Paul Robeson, yes. Okay, I'm sorry, but I'm glad I remembered his name. Can't believe I forgot it.
Tell me a little bit about your Bayreuth experience. How did you find the place? Did you feel particularly inspired there for all that goes with singing in the Festspielhaus?
I was greatly inspired, needless to say. I mean, this is the mecca, let's say, of Wagnerian music. And the fact that no African-American man had ever sung there before, and the fact that no American had ever sung, even to this day, not male nor female, had ever sung a title role and opened the season in a new production. So I felt I felt honored in a way. I really did feel honored. And it was a challenge. I sang Flying Dutchman in Zurich the year before I went to Bayreuth, and that's how Wolfgang Wagner actually heard about my singing, are going to sing the Dutchman in Zurich, Switzerland. That is kind of an interesting story. It'll take a couple of minutes. I went over a couple of years before that, and I auditioned for the Opera House in Zurich, and the director of the Opera House, Dr. Dreza, he offered me a new production of Macbeth. And I told him, I said, well, I do Banco, because I'd already sung Banco, the Chicago Lyric Opera, and I'm bass baritone, and Macbeth, of course, is a baritone role. And I said, so I assumed he meant Banco. He said, no, Macbeth. I said, well, I can't do that, because my friend Norman Mittelmann, who was the top leading baritone in Zurich, I said, he's my friend, and he sings that role. I said, and I'm staying with him and his family. I said, I just couldn't do that. And he looked at me very strange. He said, you're telling me that you won't sing because a friend sings that role, and I'm offering you a new production, and you're not going to take it? I said, well, I would love to do it. I said, I will really sing Banco. I said, but Norman is my friend, and he does this role and all these baritone roles, and he sang with Placido Domingo and all those other great singers. I remember he looked at me. He said, I've never met anybody like you before in my life who would give up a title role in new production for a friend. I said, well, friendship means a lot to me. He said, well, I have nothing else to offer you. He said, come back next year. So the next year I went back, and he offered me a new production of Porgy, to do Porgy. And I said, Dr. Reyes, I'll be happy to do Porgy. I said, but I don't want to become stereotyped. And I said, therefore, you have to offer me something else in the same season so that I will not be stereotyped. He said, you're quite a businessman. I can still remember that conversation. I said, no, it's not business. I said, it's this kind of reality. I said, so many African-American singers, if they get recognition as having sung in Porgy and Bess, then they become stereotyped, and that's all they can sing. And he said, well, I'll do a new production of The Flying Dutchman. And I thought he was going to give me the role of Dahlon, the bass. And I said, well, sure. I said, do you mean Dahlon? He said, no, I want you to do the title role, Hollander. I said, oh, okay. So I did that in the same calendar year. And during the rehearsals in the fall of 77, Wolfgang Wagner heard about me. And the man who's going to direct the production was Harry Kupfer. And so I flew to Bayreuth, auditioned on that famous Festspiel stage. As soon as I finished singing, Wolfgang Wagner said, of course, this is all in German, he said, I want you to come here and sing the title of The Flying Dutchman. I want you to open the season in a new production. Will you do it? Obviously, I said yes. And so I went there, and to get back to what you originally asked me, it was an honor. I would have to say I realized I had a huge responsibility on my shoulders, because I knew that no African-American man had ever sung there, and Grace sang there that one year, but only in the one opera, and it wasn't a title role. So I had a lot of pressure, I would say, but I accepted it as a challenge. Fortunately, I had a chance to sing the role before I got to Bayreuth, and so I was very, very excited. because some of the press was critical of the fact that I was going to sing Hollander, that gave me some concern. But I said to myself, you know, and I'm a very devout Christian, I'm sure I just put all my faith and trust in the Lord, and it ended up being that even catapulted my career more when I had production. You can see that on DVD and everything, and it was recorded and everything. But I was not, I wasn't really nervous, because I always felt that nervousness, and I'm talking about shaky nervousness, I always looked at myself as being like a racehorse. You know, you can't wait till the gate goes up and you go charging out of there. And so I had that sort of excitement. And because I was so involved in the role and having sung it in Zurich before, I felt really secure in the role. I felt very humbled, very, very humbled that I was invited to sing this role there. And as it ended up, as you probably know, and I say this with all the humility I can, it was a tremendous success. The whole production was a great success, but there were critics that were written about me, which if ever you want to get them, we could probably get them to, that were just really phenomenal. And so that really, in 78, after Bayreuth, it just really, although I'd already sung in Vienna and London and Paris and Zurich and in Italy, I'd already sung in Bologna, I'd already sung at La Scala, I'd already sung in most of the opera houses. So Bayreuth, though, is Bayreuth. There's only one Bayreuth in the world.
That's right.
And so that's why that was a deep, deep, deep honor.
Well, speaking of spirituals and the spiritual life, mm-hmm. when you, I know you've recorded an album with spirituals.
Yes.
And I'm curious to know if, once again, if this is something that in which the image of Marian Anderson loomed very large, that this was something that can and should be done and brought into the world as concert music.
Yes. Yes, I absolutely do believe this. And on all of my recitals that I sang, I was with Columbia Artist Management. I got with Columbia Artist Management right after the Tchaikovsky competition in Moscow. And the first year I got with CAMI, I did 45 recitals, because in those days it was very difficult, as you know, for African-American men to get opera, although I was getting some opera, but not what I should have been given. But as I look back on it now, I still think it was wrong to have been discriminated against. But I realize now it was a blessing in disguise, because I didn't just sing only opera. I continued to do recitals, Schubert, Wolf, Brahms, Mahler, Negro spirituals. On every recital that I sang, and to this day, I always include a group of Negro spirituals, because Marian Anderson sang these songs. And, of course, before she ever got to make her debut at the Met, she did a lot of recitals, singing, as you obviously know, in orchestral work, but she always sang Negro spirituals. And I feel that all of us should sing Negro spirituals. I was a professor at Boston University for 5 years, as you may or may not know. I just retired from here about, I think, 3 years ago. But I started teaching a course in the art of singing the American Negro spiritual, because the Negro spirituals are some of the greatest music ever written, composed, or arranged. I mean, and the text, of course, always has an incredible impact and meaning, you know, very subtle, because of discrimination that black people had in the times of slavery. So they'd say, go down, Moses, go down in Egypt land and let my people go. We were actually saying, tell the white man in Mississippi to let us go. So they had to always use these metaphors, and Joshua fought the battle of Jericho and the walls came tumbling down. They always had this double meaning to them. And so therefore, I felt as an African-American, number one, I wanted to sing those songs. And I felt it was a responsibility to my forefathers, whether they were singers or slave people working in cotton fields, to acknowledge what they started singing in the cotton fields. I felt that responsibility to do that, and I was honored to do it. And to this very day, when I do recitals, I always do Negro spirituals also, because Marian Anderson let us know that we could and should do it.
Well, as you say, the thing that really struck me re-listening to some of her recordings in preparation for this show, I was stunned, and I didn't remember them being so powerful, both Crucifixion and Go Down Moses. And as you say, really was reminded, to my mind, of the intersection and why black singers find lead so attractive, because I believe there is an absolute intersection between the as you say, the spiritual depth and meaning of the spirituals and that same thing you find in the romantic lead. They're very, very
Absolutely.
Close.
Absolutely, yes.
Well, tell me a little bit about what you're doing now. I know that, as a matter of fact, I thought you were at Boston University, and I had this vision of my best friend lives there, and I thought, oh, maybe one day if I'm ever up there, when I'm up there again, I'll call him. But you've left there now, and so you are now in the Midwest, and are you teaching voice? I know you're doing a lot of humanitarian work. What are your activities right now?
Well, right now, I'm a professor at Iowa State University here in Ames, Iowa, also at Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa, which is a private college, and that's a great, great college. I've even taken the Wartburg Choir along with me when I went to South Africa. They sang at my school because, as you may or may not know, I founded the Simon Estes Music High School 16 years ago in Cape Town. And my choir has sung for President Clinton. They sung in the Nelson Mandelas. I've sung for Nelson Mandela, Archbishop Desmond Tutu. So I mentioned that because Wartburg College Choir, we went to Europe, and I took them to South Africa. But I'm still teaching. I've been teaching at Iowa State University for the last 14 years and at Wartburg the last 10 years. I was at Boston University for 5 years. They just reappointed me for another 5 years. But I was just so much commuting among these three educational institutions and still singing. I'm still doing maybe 30, 35 performances a year. And when I was at Boston, I did a Verdi Requiem with the orchestra there and went to New York at Carnegie Hall with him and performed. But it was just a little. It was just a little too much, and so I retired from Boston University. I'm involved in a lot of humanitarian events. I brought my choir over this past summer from South Africa, and they performed throughout Iowa as well as Iowa State University, Wartburg College, sang for the governor at the Rotunda in the Capitol here in Iowa. We performed in Tulsa, Oklahoma, for my Simon Estes Educational Foundation in Tulsa that I founded 28 years ago. Helped raise them more than $3 million. We've given 333 scholarships. And then we went down to Rotary, my choir and I, and performed for Rotary's international convention that they had down there in New Orleans. This was last summer. And there were over 25,000 people there. My choir and I sang for them, too. And so I'm still singing. I do lots of lectures and master classes all around the world. As I say, I'm doing 30, 35 performances a year. Here in Iowa, I just started in 2010. We have 99 counties in Iowa, and I decided because my wife suggested, you know, Simon, you're doing so much at Boston, you know, you should take it easy. Not take it easy, but maybe not have to travel so much. So I came out to Iowa, and it just, I think God led me to, well, why don't I sing in all 99 counties and raise money for scholarships? So I've now sung in about a third of them since March 2010. I'm given 53 scholarships. I give 50% of my fee back to the Simon Estes Educational Foundation to give scholarships to needy students. And my Simon Estes Educational Foundation told us, I said, we've given 333 scholarships to students over 56 different colleges and universities out there in the United States, including Harvard and Yale, on down or on up, whichever way you want to look at it. And so I do a lot in that respect. When I sang for the grand finale concert for the World Cup in Johannesburg, South Africa, in July of 2010. And my choir, I brought them up from Cape Town to sing there, too, and the president of South Africa was there. And while I was there, I heard about this horrible situation of black children. When I was there, they said every 30 seconds a black child dies of a mosquito bite from malaria, and all they need is a $5 net, which has to be treated to sleep under these nets. So my heart was touched, and so now I'm in the process. I've already raised a certain amount of money to give to some organization to help buy nets. And so I'm involved in a lot of humanitarian events and educational events because I feel that God has given me this gift to sing, which has led me to be able to do other things. I do all of this to the glory of God, not for Simon Estes. I do this for the glory of God. In loving and caring and sharing and speaking and singing, all of those gifts are from God, and I use them to His glory. And He said we are supposed to serve on this earth. So that's what I'm doing now in my advanced years, and I'm just grateful to God for saying, too.
Well, you know, I would be curious to hear what you think. You've lived through what I call the bridge generation of African-American classical singers, the earliest generation of Roland Hayes and Marian Anderson
and Paul Robeson
and Matthew Wilder Dobbs.
Yep.
That extraordinary group. Then there comes another group that includes yourself and the great George Shirley and others who really get to sing on the world stage. Do you feel, what do you make of your career at that time? And do you feel that you were given the opportunities commensurate to your talents? And how do you see it now? Do you feel that black singers have finally reached the point that they can sing in all places and all stages? Or do you think there's still some reluctance when it comes to being the romantic or heroic lead?
There's definitely reluctance. And I know even some African-American people, they don't want to speak about it. I remember when I was with Columbia years ago, you know, way back in 1966 up until the mid-80s, because when people ask me interviews about racial discrimination, he said, don't talk about it, Simon. You hurt yourself. I said, I'm sorry, Michael. My manager's name is Michael Reese. I said, I'm not going to start the conversation, but somebody asked me, I'm going to tell the truth. And I remember I had just done a concert out in the state of Washington, and these people had a reception for me. And this might have been in the mid to late 70s, and they said, well, when are you going to be singing at the Met? I said, well, if they ever ask me, I will. So to make a long story short, the conversation came up. I said, well, there's a problem because of my skin. First, I said sociological reasons. So I didn't want to use the word race. And they said, well, you know, be more specific. So then I told them, I said, we have a number of African-American women. I said, but it's not that easy for them either. And I said, if you look at the percentages, it's very minute. And they said, they're basically the only black man right now who's really singing roles is George Shirley at the Met. And they were shocked when I said that. I said, no. I said, well, name me. I said, I remember first they said, well, they asked me this question about black singers. I said, sure, but name me one black man. They said, well, and they sent me to home. And they didn't even remember George Shirley, of course. And they couldn't. I said, well, you know what? I can't think of any. I said, there's your answer. Okay, we knew that George was at the Met. I asked them, I said, how many black conductors do we have of our major symphonic and philharmonic orchestras in the United States? How many black stage directors do we have? How many black managers do we have? How many black critics do we have for newspapers? I went right down the list. I said, look at our orchestras, because at that point, I had a son with the Philadelphia Orchestra and New York Philharmonic Orchestra, many of the orchestras, and 99% of them had no blacks in it. There was one violist in the Philharmonic Orchestra in New York of those days in the late 60s. And so I'll tell you, the problem does still exist today. I have been very blessed, and I feel a responsibility. You don't know the young black men that contact me and said, Simon, how are you able to endure all of this? And I was able to do it because of my faith in God. But I could go on for 2 hours and tell you that the areas of discrimination that even I encountered. And I in many of the roles I sang, even in Europe, although Europe was far better than I regret to say than in my own country. Oh, sure, events that I sang at the Met in Chicago, San Francisco, I had to do something which I cannot allow revealed just yet. You might hear about it later on, but I had to. Someone contacted me. I had to find out. I've sung in 87 different opera houses. I've sung in 115 orchestras around the world. I've sung over 100 roles in opera. I've sung, I don't know how many oratorio works, et cetera, et cetera, and I have a whole bunch of awards that I received. This is not to try to impress you. I'm saying it because here's a black man, forget that his name is Simon Estes, who has sung more roles than probably... I don't know. In fact, someone said I should try to find a student to find out. But there's a possibility. Even my manager in Germany said, Simon, I don't think there's another singer, including people like Luciano Pavarotti mm-hmm. and Placido Domingo. Pavarotti made a career on probably 10 roles. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I have sung 102 roles in opera.
My gosh.
I've sung 15 title roles in opera that people don't even know about. 15 title roles. And I say this, not Simon Estes. I'm talking about a African-American man who has done all of this. I don't need the recognition and praise for myself. I only want it to be something to motivate black men and to educate black people and white people that we can perform Verdi, Puccini, Mozart, Mussorgsky, Offenbach. I can go right down the list of all these composers that I have sung. All the oratorio was Haydn creation, Haydn seasons, the Messiah. I've done all of the Requiem, Verdi Requiem, Fauré Requiem, Brahms Requiem, American Requiem, Benjamin Britten War Requiem. I can go right down the list. Placido didn't do any of this. Luciano Pavarotti didn't. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not putting those guys down. I've sung with them for 40 years. Great artists. But they didn't do what a black man did. As I say, forget my name, Simon Estes. It could have been Joe Smith, a black man. Who's done what I have done, It you know what? When I had to compile all this about 2 months ago for a special occasion, I couldn't even remember all the conductors. But right now, I remembered 87. That's already
wow. Been,
but there are more. You know, I'm talking about Eugene Ormandy, Leinsdorf, Leonard Bernstein, Schulte, Zubin Mehta, Mazur, Ricardo Muti. I can go right down the list. No black singer, male or female, has sung as many operas and with as many orchestras and as many roles as I have. And I'm not bragging, sir. You have to trust me and believe me from my heart. I'm not bragging. I'm just giving you some statistics that are true.
Well, you know, I was
87 conductors, and there are more. I can't even remember though, but they were all listed. 87 conductors, 115 orchestras around the world, Australia, Russia, all of Europe, you name it.
Well, it's very interesting what you say, because as with Anderson, my producer here was stunned when I brought out this LP of her farewell recital. And he says, surely there's a CD of this. I said, no, there isn't. And this is the case also, what you're talking about, your career in America, in terms of the vastness of what you've done, I had no idea, is essentially invisible, because we don't have the recordings to tell us the range of what you've done. I was explaining to, once again, your LP of Wagner, though I think has now been re-released on CD. I have these from my LP collections. I said, it is unbelievable how difficult it is to find these things. Even Bunbury. The exceptions, of course, are Norman and Price. They are the exceptions to everything, and their recordings
well,
are everywhere.
Well, I have found that a lot of people know. I mean, I have Parsifal that I've recorded with Levine from Bayreuth. I've recorded the Verdi Requiem with Giulini, the Mozart Requiem with
That's
Giulini
right.
and the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, the Mahler Eighth Symphony with Mozell
That's
and
right.
the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. I've done, a lot of people don't even know that. I've done a whole CD of Verdi arias of Philip's classics years ago. You know, I did half Verdi baritone arias and half bass arias. No one's ever done that in the history. And when I say title roles, I've done 15 title roles. I've done almost everything that Verdi wrote, not quite all, but all of Wagner's operas except for Meistersinger. I've done Mozart's operas in Don Giovanni, The Magic Flute, title role of Figaro, a lot of other things, Tales of Hoffman, The Four Villains. And a lot of these recordings, they're out there, but a lot of people don't know about them because they don't publicize them. They don't market. When you were talking before about discrimination, even though I was well paid, my voice teacher who discovered me was a white man. He was always so frustrated because even though I was singing all these opera houses, you name it, every major opera house in the world I have sung in, I was still underpaid as a black man. If I was singing a role like the Flying Dutchman, the title role, the white man who was singing Dalan, which was a bass role, he was paid more than I was paid.
Unbelievable.
When I sang in San Francisco years ago, I was singing in productions with Luciano Pavarotti and Placido Domingo, Shirley Verrett. I did Aida, I did L'Africaine, and Lucia di Lammermoor. This was in, I can't remember the year, but I could certainly find out. I remember Pavarotti was in Lucia di Lammermoor with Beverly Sills. Shirley Verrett and Placido Domingo were in L'Africaine. And Aida was Richard Cassily, and I don't remember, because later on I did Aida out there with Leontine Price and Margot Price. But anyhow, I was with Columbia Artist Management, and Kurt Herbert Adler, who was the director of the Opera House at that time, offered me these three operas, so I was excited. But he wouldn't pay me properly. And Michael Rees, my manager, said, look, you can't pay Simon this amount of money, because see, all the other artists in those days, I would imagine that Placido and Shirley Verrett and Pavarotti, I bet they're probably getting, because this was a long time ago, but I'm sure they were getting probably $15,000, $20,000 a performance. Adler would only pay me on a weekly contract. We calculated what it would be per performance. I was getting $257 a performance. And you know what he told my manager, Michael Rees? He said, take it or leave it. Just like that. I will never forget any of this. I needed to sing with people like Pavarotti, Shirley Verrett, Placido Domingo, Beverly Sills. So I had to take it. I had to borrow money to stay out there. I didn't feel sorry for myself. To this day, I don't feel sorry for myself. But I was hurt. Because I'm a human being with emotions. I was hurt, but I swallowed my human pride and went ahead and did it. It was important, as you know, to have performed with artists of that caliber.
Absolutely.
but I was always, always, always underpaid.
That's
and that still goes on today. And to answer your question, no. Okay, we have Lawrence, what's his name, the young tenor who's singing at the Met right now.
Right. I can't think of his name now, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's about the only one right now. And I hope you will forgive me for being a little bit repetitive, but if you think I've sung 102 roles, I've sung in 87 different conductors around the world. As I said, I've sung with 115 different orchestras all around the world. If a white man had done that, they'd have him so much publicity, it'd be unbelievable. And when I say roles, sure, I did small roles, but I did all the big roles. And again, I don't want you to think about Simon Essex. I want you to think of a black man, an African-American man, who's done all of that, and they don't even know about it.
This is absolutely the case. One of the things, as I was beginning to put together this show, I was explaining to everyone, I said, I'm very curious to see what Mr. Estes thinks of the change that's taken place from the time of Anderson through the time of Leontine Price and George Shirley into his own time, the difficulties he may have had, though I would never have dreamed they would be of this magnitude, particularly as concerns the pay scale. That's simply scandalous. But I do know that I had read somewhere that George Shirley had spoken years ago about some of this, and it really shocked people because they weren't aware, and I wasn't aware, of the magnitude of this. But I had always suspected because I thought, you know, it's very odd. When you look back, particularly since, let's say, Marian Anderson's time, because she really is the benchmark for all these things, when she broke through, I said, you know, it's really been the women that have gotten both the publicity.
Oh, of course.
And the great critical acclaim and write-up. And I was curious in your case because I thought, you know, I wonder in all those years in Europe, and once again, the bifurcation of your career that you were having, as I understand it, difficulties getting the proper roles in the States.
I got some, as you obviously know. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the Met, I sang Amfortas, I sang Lankaroff, I sang, of course, Porgy. I sang Votan at the Met. I sang an Electra. I think it was Electra. Was it Solomon? I can't remember right now. But I did some roles at the Met. But it was always very difficult. I remember when we did the Porgy and Bess. You might be interested in this. Joan Ingpen was the artistic director at the Met at that time. They contacted me, and they wanted me to do Porgy, and they wanted Grace to do Bess. So I agreed to do it. So I spoke with Joan Ingpen. I've always been a fighter for African-American people, male and female, but in that I'm a male and there were more women, I had to fight more for the black man. So I remember I said to Joan Ingpen, I said, she didn't like it because of the way I approached it. I said, so you're going to bring Porgy and Bess to the Met? She says, oh, yes, and with great pride. I said, so that means you're going to use operatic voices. She says, oh, yes, of course, this is the Met. This is only opera. I said, now you're sure of this? Only operatic voices? She said, yes. I said, well, in that case, then I want you to engage some of the black men in other operas other than Porgy. Where her face dropped like you had no, she was furious with me. Well, she said, those are our intentions. And I didn't threaten her. I said, well, if you want me to sing Porgy and Bess, and you just said to me that all of the voices that are going to be singing Porgy and Bess are going to be operatic voices, then I said, I expect you to give them some other roles other than Porgy and Bess. I mean, Porgy and Bess. I remember Great Baker did Crown, and I can't remember who did Jake. He actually died. He was a baritone. And I think Charlie Williams and the other guy who did a TV program on, maybe it's moving on up to the East Side. I can't remember that guy's name. He did The Sporting Life, he and Charlie Williams. But, so Joan Ingpen was so angry with me. I said, well, look, you just said they were going to be offering voices, so give them something other than Porgy and Bess. Well, she ended up doing it. And Greg Baker got a few roles, as you may know, a few things. But, you know, the problem still exists, sir. I want you to know that. Look, tell me how many black conductors there are of any of the major symphonic or philharmonic orchestras in the United States.
Well, you know, this is one of the more really comical questions. I interviewed for Black History Month 2 years ago Paul Freeman. And Paul Freeman's real work is not with the Sinfonietta in Chicago and the work that he does with the Sphinx people, but his real work is in Czechoslovakia, is in Prague.
Of course.
I mean, this is incredible. And this is into the present day.
James the Priest. You know James the
Priest.
Right.
Yes, of course.
Okay, I did a Verdi record on him for King of Monaco years ago. The king was at Grace Bunbury, or not Grace, but Grace Kelly had already been killed in a car accident. Right. I've sung for lots of kings and queens. People don't know that either. I really have. I'm not bragging again. I've sung for 6 presidents of the United States and have met 7 presidents of the United States. I met Harry Truman before he died in New York City. But, I forgot my point there. James the Priest, yeah. So he conducted this Verdi Requiem. I was driving maybe a couple of months ago here in Iowa between Ames, Iowa, and Waverly, Iowa, where Wartburg College is. And I'm always listening to my classical station, and I heard this Mahler 8th Symphony, which I mean Mahler 5th, the Mahler 5th Symphony. And I've always admired the way Leonard Bernstein conducted the Mahler 5th.
Right.
I mean, he was great because he really brought Mahler into, you know, more
That's right.
publicly opinions. But when I thought, I've never heard a conductor like this. When it was over, it was a recording of James the Priest. And I'm telling you, James Priest, I am going to get that recording. It, because I love the Mahler 5th. I've recorded the Mahler 8th. I love Mahler. I told you, Mazel, I recorded with Gielen, another conductor in Frankfurt, Germany. I've done 2 different recordings of that. I've recorded the Verdi record with Muti, with Giulini, etc. I can go on, and the Mozart record, all those things. But for the black man to get the recognition and to be paid, that we are still way behind. We're still way behind. Now, I don't know of another African male singer who's doing big leading roles at the Met right now. As some of us who get together and talk, if things are going backward again, I think they almost feel, well, we've done our bit. We had Lantine and Martina Roy and Grace Bumby and Shirley Brett and eventually George Shirley and eventually Simon Estes. And so we've done our bit now. That's the way we look at it. You know, there's just very few of us there now.
Yeah, I think that right now, and it's something that I hope one day to interview Derek Lee Reagan. I think that now, probably there are probably more black singers singing in early music than in the romantic music at the major opera houses. It's a strange situation, but I believe that may well be the case. And, of course, Roberta Alexander, a lovely singer. Well, these are some of the things you've spoken of. Are the questions that I knew you would you've answered all the questions that I had, and particularly this. The question of the degree to which you think things have changed and, of course, the difficulties you ran into, and this question, as you say, of value and worth that in our culture is in terms of money and fame and the degree.
Could you hold on just one second?
Sure.
I have a call coming in. It might be just one moment.
Sure.
Hello?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did. I thought it might have been I have a daughter who's flew over to Taiwan, and I thought it might have been perhaps with she, but I didn't get to it in time. Just letting me know that she arrived.
Okay.
But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Right. Well, I think that the revelation not only of the range of what you've done, of which I was completely unaware, and I'm an opera fanatic, but I had always wondered because, as I said, of this, you've had these dual careers, and I thought, it's interesting. I wonder, what were the roles that he got to sing in Europe as opposed to the roles he got to sing here? And I see now.
Well, all those basically 87 roles that I mentioned to you, or, I mean 102 roles, most of them in Europe. You know what? If you would like me to, and now this is not for Simon Estes, okay? But if you'd like me to email to you all the roles and all the opera houses and orchestras with which I performed and conductors, I'll email that to you and you'll have it.
I would love to have it, sir. That would be lovely.
Let me give you my email address.
All right.
It's SOSESTES at MCHSI.com.
At,
so it's SOS like the distress
all right.
system. My last name is Estes.
Estes.
You always say help Estes, you know.
Right. And
SOS Estes at MCHSI.com.
SI.
M like Mary.
Right.
C like Charlie. H like Henry. S like Sam.
MCHSI.com.
Yeah. And I'll get that to you at the beginning of the week. I'll get that compiled for you. And just so you'll have it. That's
no,
all.
I would love to have that because I was telling a friend that as talking to you and talking to Denise Graves, and I'm going to talk to one of the recent biographers of Anderson a little bit an Aloha by the name of Kyler. This is an extraordinary revelation, and I wondered to what degree this was true. And I think at some point, if he bears out much of what I'm thinking, that I may also try to make an essay out of this. This is an amazing thing. I can't tell you what a pleasure it's been to talk to you. You're someone I've admired for many, many years. I actually met you years ago when you came to San Antonio and you sang some Wagner, including Wotan's Farewell. You came here, and a friend of mine was a critic at the paper then, and we met briefly.
It's interesting you were there. When I was at the University of Iowa, I wanted to sing in the university chorus. This was in the late 50s. I went to the choral director and said, could I sing in the choir? And there were 300 voices in the University of Iowa choir. Not one black. Long story short, he said, well, no, your voice isn't good enough. I said, oh, well, then, because he was the head of the voice department, and he lived in San Antonio. You know the name Harold Stark?
Yes.
Harold Stark was at head of the chair of the voice department at the University of Iowa when I was there in the late 50s and early 60s. So he said, no, your voice isn't good enough. And so I was very naive. I wasn't even angry because I was naive, I guess, having come from Centerville, Iowa. I decided, well, I guess my voice isn't good enough, although I've been singing since I was a kid. I said, could I take voice lessons with you? He said, I would not waste my time with you. He said, your voice isn't good enough. He said, however, there's a young teacher coming here this fall. This was 1963. He said, and maybe he'll take you. I said, okay, because I just wanted to sing. That's the way, Mr. Kellis, or I wouldn't be talking to you today. Now, when I sang in San Antonio, after that performance, who came up? Harold Stark. So he said, well, hello, Simon. I said, oh, hello, Mr. Stark. How are you? He said, I'm fine. He said, well, I see you're doing quite well for yourself. I said, well, thank you very much. I said, I'm just trying my best. And he walked away. Well, I told many other people this story. They said, well, you should have wiped him out and said, remember when you said my voice wasn't going to blow? I said, no. I said, it wasn't necessary to do that. He heard.
Amazing.
And he saw.
Amazing.
And that was enough. But he wouldn't let... I've had discrimination with singing ever since the University of Iowa days. I was the first black singer to sing in the old Gold Singers. That's another long story at the University of Iowa. I broke down segregation at the University of Iowa because when I went to the University of Iowa, black men couldn't share a room with a white man at the University of Iowa.
Wow.
I've gone through all of this.
Well, it's...
But the power of God... the Lord is my strength and my salvation.
Well, it has been an extraordinary career. This has been a wonderful conversation. I can't thank you enough. Thank you for giving me so much of your time.
Well,
I look forward to...
Thank you for being patient with me with having to answer two calls to my daughter. Thank you very much.
No problem.
Email me now at your address and everything, and I'll get that to you next week.
I will, and I thank you. We have been in conversation with Simon Estes, one of the premier singers of American classical music, about his career and in this Black History Month about the situation of the black singer in the 20th into the 21st century. We thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.